Well, maybe we should think about starting. It's okay, Steve. All is forgiven.
I understand.
Sit there and David sit here.
I told him I wanted him over there. This is makes it easier to see the whole group of people. Well, let's take our seats. I want to welcome you all to the fourth and final day of this round table, and as we all, I think, expected, there's been a slight falling off in attendance because some from out of town had to return home last night, but I'm glad that you're all here this morning. We've had some questions about transcripts and so on, and maybe I could just say that there will be a series of four transcripts of the 4 days of our discussions here at the round table, and we will have Steve Langdon's paper printed as the fifth volume of the transcript of these proceedings, because many have referred to it. It hasn't been read in, and I think it's a useful background to all that has been said. The transcripts will be prepared in the next few weeks. They will be available from the Commission at a nominal charge, as described in the handout on the table by the door. But if a participant or the organization that you represent, if you can't afford the transcripts, other arrangements can be made. Just speak to Don Gamble, who's over there, or Joyce Johnson, who is the back there. And also, we're having an index made, and you can speak to Joyce and Don about that as well. Well, what I thought we would do this morning is this, if it meets with your approval. Harvey Fite will continue with his outline of subsistence under the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement in Canada, and we will then have the opportunity of asking him some questions and making observations. Then we will ask Dan Gross to talk about subsistence in South America and the Third World generally, and we will ask him some questions and make any observations about his presentation. And then to conclude, I thought we would ask Joe Meeker to draw back and indicate what, in his view, is the meaning of all of this, and to indicate the lessons not only for the Arctic and subarctic regions of the world, but what does all this mean to Americans in the lower 48, urban Anchorage, ites, and the urban world generally. And then I thought, giving Joe later this morning the chance to lead that discussion off, we might just all participate and each feel free, each of us feel free to offer any views on what we've been discussing here, and particularly on what Joe has in mind. And then we will take as long as we think appropriate with that discussion, and then we will adjourn. So I should say that when we adjourn today, we will be inviting you all back to the offices of the Alaska Native Review Commission for refreshments. So we are ready to resume the discussion of Harvey Fite's presentation of the subsistence regime under the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement in Canada. Harvey had told us yesterday about the income support program to enable Cree families to live out on the land, and he had indicated to us the extent to which the families had increased, that is, the numbers living out on the land had increased, and yet there had been no undue pressure on big game. Just two things to bear in mind. The figures regarding the dollars that Harvey used are, I believe, Canadian dollars, and so you should deduct 25% if you're making the conversion to American to real money, real. And the other thing, I was just going to suggest to Harvey that he might tell us at some point before he concludes his presentation whether this is really just a glorified welfare scheme that they've thought up in James Bay in Northern Quebec, and how he would answer that that suggestion. So, the floor is yours again, Harvey.
Okay, thank you. I thought I'd touch on three issues, and I think they match the question as well. One would be to pick up with the theme of self-government and self-management and talk a bit about the Cree system of self-management and self-government and how that relates to the structure of the agreement. The second would be to deal with how the agreement was structured on the assumption, as I understand it, that self-management could be coordinated and to some degree integrated with relationships with government and with joint management with government. And that is, that it didn't necessarily mean a radical separation. And then thirdly, I thought I'd just pick up some of the themes that have struck me the last few days that just rang a lot of resonances with things that had come out of the experience that I shared in James Bay, and just throw those out as themes that seem to me to be common and possibly basic. The Cree objective is, as I understand it, is and was self-governance and sovereignty. The sovereignty issue is a long-term objective, and within the terms of the James Bay Agreement, there was really an opportunity to pursue self-governance and self-management much more than there was an opportunity to pursue. Sovereignty as such, although new opportunities to pursue sovereignty have come with the revision of the Canadian Constitution. Within the goal of self-governance and self-management, I think we can see that goal working in something like the income security program. People in the James Bay area had been using money coming from the government for a long time in order to subsidize or finance their cash needs in the hunting sector since the period of the 1940s, when basic social security benefits started to be paid, they represented a very significant part of the cash income, and Cree hunters had used those benefits in order to meet the needs for new weapons, new equipment, the services they needed in order to continue hunting. The problem was that they felt that at the same time that these funds were aiding in their hunting and subsistence activities, they also felt that it was creating a dependence on government. And this didn't come to a head for a couple of decades until the early 1960s, when the government, economic development started to occur in the James Bay region. Mines opened, forest developments opened, and the government said, well, people should give up hunting and take real work. They should start employment. And in order to force people into employment, the government started to change the way it paid welfare. For example, it wouldn't pay social aid benefits at 3 or 4 months block so that people could go out on the land for 3 or 4 months and then come back. They started to pay it on a monthly basis. They started to insist that the children had to be in school if people wanted to get social security payments. And so it really came to a head in the 1960s that dependence on government funding and on the cash needs of hunting could really constrain people's ability to go out on the land and to use the land the way they wanted. They had to adapt their organization to meet the demands and pressures that were being put on them. And so in looking at alternatives, people tried to design in the income security program a program that gave them the freedom to use money as they wanted and that restricted the government's ability to use those funds to control them and to direct what they were doing. And the key elements were, for example, that the government is obliged to transfer the funds to the board, but the government itself has no other say once the agreement was reached in how the program works. The program is structured and government can't change it unilaterally. It can't set up a new set of rules for paying those monies. Those monies are paid according to the principles set out, and the principles include both the structure of the program and the principle that it shall aid and assist the maintenance of Cree hunting and its autonomy. There's also a basic right of beneficiaries to benefit, unlike social aid payments or anything like that. Beneficiaries who qualify, who spend enough time hunting, have the right to receive benefits. And if the government tries to play with the terms, they have a right to go to court and challenge them. So that there was a structural or a formal legal sense in which the Cree sought to make this program a program that would transfer funds from the governments, but that would do it in a way that allowed them complete freedom on how they used and disposed of those monies, how they adapted it to their needs as hunters, what they spent it on and how, and on the other side that allowed, that didn't allow the government any opportunity or hardly any opportunity to try and use the transfer of those funds to manipulate or alter the Cree economic system. In terms of, I'll take that one step further, I guess. That's sort of the legal formal view of it. I think there are other views. The government justifies its participation in the program largely as a job creation program. Government doesn't treat it as a welfare program. When this program is defended in public, when it goes before Parliament and the funding is discussed, it's discussed as a job creation program. It's a means of creating productive work or making productive work possible for a sector of the people of Quebec and Canada. And it's seen in that sense much like job creation programs where governments give aid to various industries and various corporations to create jobs. It's another form of government, the use of government funds to create the possibility of productive activity in the economy, much as it would be in grants to the mining sector or to forestry to train and create jobs for people. So that's the way it gets publicly legitimated by the government. In terms of people in the Cree communities, I think people in the Cree communities have always, they share that view, I think, in part. First, there has been no history of the Cree feeling that welfare made them dependent. The traditional view, as I've understood it in the Cree communities, was always that welfare was a payment for a long history of exploitation. and people have never allowed themselves, or people have never, I've never heard the comment that, the negative comment about welfare dependence even before income security. With respect to income security, people view it as a very clear statement that a very clear payment for a productive activity. You don't get it just because you get your CRE, you get it because you go out and you do hard work and work that people want to do and work that people feel is productive. The problem that people say is that we just don't get enough cash from that. We get food, we get housing, we get medicine, we get clothes, we get the equipment we make, we do all of these things and we're productive, and yet we don't have enough cash out of it by selling our furs, because that's the major thing that we can produce out of that activity. And so people see it as a payment for or related to the fact that they're active and productive. And so in the communities, in the CRE villages, people, I think, don't see it as a welfare system. Having said that everyone doesn't look at it as a welfare system, that doesn't mean that there aren't people in the public who say, look at those guys over there ripping off the government. There is a sector of the public that certainly says that. But I think the key element is that there is a reply to that, and replies to that are made by everyone involved, from the government agencies to the native people themselves. So the income security program was essentially seen as a program that really aided CRE self-governance and CRE management. I guess to make that clear, I wanted to talk, if I could, I'll try and make it in about 5 minutes, about what I understand of the CRE system of self-governance and the kind of knowledge and social organization that it depends on. CRE hunters, CRE lands are divided into hunting territories that are contiguous tracts of land that range anywhere from about 100 square miles up to about 1,500 square miles. And there are approximately 300 of these in the CRE area. The territories are said to be owned by individual CRE, usually elders, and they have their men who've hunted on these lands usually over the course of their lives and over several decades. And they're people who develop a tremendous sense of the history of wildlife and a tremendous knowledge of the wildlife of that land. And this was critical in negotiating the James Bay Agreement, because the CRE were trying to say to the government, we have a system of management that allows us to regulate wildlife and to manage the key wildlife resources. And we want a system in this agreement that recognizes our ability and that doesn't conflict with it and doesn't reduce that ability. And so they had to argue with government agents over the table that they could in fact and were in fact managing wildlife resources. And they sat down and explained over the negotiating table how the kind of knowledge that people collected, how the hunters, the managers of the hunting territories, how they could talk about trends in game populations, how they could manage moose and beaver. They talked about how in the case of moose, people watch trends in the frequency of the twinning, the birth of twin animals, how they looked at changes in the frequency of conception and birth among the adult females. They talked about how they looked at trends in the age structure of the population. They talked about how they looked at trends in the total number of moose. They talked about how they looked at trends in how many moose would live together in winter. And all of these factors that they were looking at are precisely the factors that game and wildlife managers try to look at in order to determine how a moose population is doing, whether it's in strong biological condition or not. Except that, of course, CRE hunters could talk about how these indicators of the condition of moose had developed and how they had evolved over decades. And they could do it with detailed knowledge of each 100 or 300 square miles of land, whereas wildlife managers had to talk about what they thought about those things on the basis of a one-month survey every 3 years over 100,000 square miles. And so the point was effectively made, I think, in those discussions that CRE did have knowledge that could be recognized, and that was knowledge that non-native scientists had to recognize was appropriate knowledge about the game and wildlife. Some of the things that they mentioned in these discussions were, and in the court case, were really kind of bowled people over. I remember one that was really interesting was that in the case of beaver, they look at the cohort, the number of young in each colony and so forth, but they mentioned that when women butcher beaver, they look for placental scars in the female beaver in order to determine how many young the female have had in the previous birthing season. And so they were using precisely the methods that biologists would have liked to use, except that the Cree were examining possibly 700 beaver a year, whereas biologists were examining 25 beaver every 5 years in order to get an idea of what was going on reproductively. And so that the point was really made that Cree had a tremendous amount of knowledge, and that there was the knowledge in order to that was needed in order to manage game. I think also that the argument was made that the Cree cultural system, Cree beliefs, although phrased in a very different way than a scientific system, were beliefs that incorporated obvious ecological principles. The basic idea of the unity of man and animals spiritually and materially and practically was essentially, I don't want to reduce it to the statement, but it's very similar to the very cold practical scientific statement that there's an ecosystem which relates us all together. And if you use Cree knowledge, you end up with a similar, you end up with possibly a better and more subtle set of understandings, but you don't end up with something that conflicts with ecological science and knowledge. You end up with something that's better than ecological science and knowledge, possibly. So that there was a strong argument made that the Cree had a system of self-governance and self-management and that it had to be respected. That was done in the agreement largely by deciding that the agreement itself should recognize the essential elements of the Cree system, but it shouldn't define them, and it shouldn't constrain them and formalize them in any way. So that in the James Bay Agreement, there are really just two or three key statements made about it. One says that everyone recognizes that there's a system of hunting territories. They're called trap lines, technically, in this area, although they're quite different from the kind of trap lines Peter's been talking about. That there is a system of trap lines, and that a trap line, it defines a trap line. A trap line is under the area of a Cree tallyman, as he's called in the agreement, a Cree elder. And then it says a Cree tallyman is a man who's recognized by the Cree community as looking after a Cree trap line. So the definitions essentially leave it entirely to the Cree community to define what hunting territories are and what the owners of hunting territories are, what their rights and responsibilities are. And then there's one other principle, which is namely that in everything that's done under the agreement, the Cree system shall be respected, and that the first action that should be taken whenever possible is one of self-governance. That is, it's the regime set up should advise the Cree. The Cree will participate in determining that advice, and then the Cree manage as they see fit, using their own system. Okay, so that essentially the agreement was set up to recognize the Cree management system and to only interfere with it to only interface with it if and when problems arose. I'll just quickly go through the issue of rights and of management of the structure of the agreement. The key elements there were first a recognition of, in addition to a recognition of the Cree system of management, there was a recognition of the universal right to harvest. There's a right to hunt, fish, and trap called the right to harvest at any time, at all places, wherever it's physically possible. The only constraints on it are similar to some of the discussion we've heard here. The only constraints are it can't be exercised where it creates possible danger to other people, and it's subject to a principle of conservation. And the principle of conservation in the James Bay Agreement was defined to recognize Cree priority in the use of game. I guess I should see if I can read that. Conservation is the pursuit of optimum natural productivity of all living resources and the protection of the ecological systems of the territory. so as to protect endangered species and to ensure primarily the continuance of traditional pursuits of native people, and secondarily the satisfaction of the needs of non-native people for sport hunting and fishing. So it makes clear that whenever there's to be, in the name of conservation, some action by the Joint Cree Government Committee that's established, which I'll talk about, it has to be done on the principle that the first thing is to protect the resources, the second thing is to protect Cree use of resources, and the third thing is needs of non-native people. And there was a sense that that was a basis on which a reasonable compromise could be struck, because the Cree themselves had been saying very clearly that their primary concern was the protection of wildlife resources and habitat. And they felt that if that was the recognized principle, then it could work, and if their needs were primary, it could work. Management in the James Bay Agreement is under the kind of boards that we've been hearing about, the joint boards. There's a board of 50% Cree and government people who...
50% Cree, 50% government.
Yes, sorry. It's much more complicated. It's 50% native, 50% government. It actually is a board that involves three native groups at this point. It involves Cree, Inuit of Northern Quebec, and the Skapi of Quebec, and it involves the federal government and the provincial government.
But in the end, it's 50% native, each. 50% government.
Yes, exactly. And the board has certain key decision-making powers. It decides the number of moose and caribou that can be killed, but in other instances it's an advisory board advising the minister and advising native parties. It's the minister himself must consult the board, he must respect in his decisions all of the basic principles that govern the regime. I don't think I should really go through those in detail. The key issue, I think, is that the board can only work when there's a conservation problem, when one party, native party or government party, says there's a problem of conservation. It brings it to the board, and there has to be a demonstration of the problem. That is, there has to be some evidence that there's a conservation problem if the other parties don't agree. And then if the board decides that it should act, it acts first in an advisory capacity. It recommends to the governments or to the native parties that they should take action, and the assumption is that each would take action within their jurisdictions. If those actions are inappropriate or ineffective, then the board has the power to recommend to the minister that he take some legal step and use the policing powers and enforcement powers to try and bring some action. The agreement also sets up various forms of local government that I guess I should mention briefly. Local government under the agreement and regional governments under the agreement are very different for the Inuit and the Cree. The Inuit have a regional government that's non-ethnically defined and that covers the entire region of northern Quebec, where they're in a clear majority. The Cree have a regional government that applies primarily to their own territories and their own community lands. The difference arising from the fact that in the south there were already large native communities, cities established within the Cree lands, and there was extensive non-native use of the lands, and it was impossible to effectively negotiate a control over those for the Cree. So the Cree regional government is ethnically defined in effect because it only applies to Cree lands. Within Cree lands, the Cree have under a law just passed this spring, a new set of government structures that are non-profit corporations. Every member of the community is in effect a decision maker and a shareholder. They don't have the share pattern, and they're corporations that have just started, so it's hard to say how they'll work, but it's taken 6 years to negotiate them because the Cree have been very insistent that the form of these governments be very different from the usual Indian affairs form and very different from any normal corporate structure. And so they've taken away powers that usually resided with the Minister of Indian Affairs and taken them back to the community. And then within the community, they've divided on the way decisions should be made on different kinds of issues. For many administrative and practical issues, they've said that an elected council should have the decision-making authority. For issues relating to hunting and trapping, relating to the alienation of lands, they've said that these are essentially community decisions, and they've tried to give that a presence in a corporate form by saying that, in effect, the decision has to be taken by 75% or 80% of community members have to concur in a decision in order for a decision of any kind of alienation or alternate use of land to take place. And so they've, I don't know how it'll work, but the people in the communities have taken a lot of time to try and work out a form of local government that's particularly adapted to their vision of how, what's practical and possible. If, I guess one final area of comment on the agreement is that the agreement also provides for a set of environmental impact assessments, a set of land use review procedures that of the kind that we've heard repeatedly discussed here in the last 3 days. They're very similar to the ones that have been talked about in the NWT and a lot of the procedures that I guess are in place here in Alaska as well. I guess I would make one comment there, and that is that those procedures have so far proved to be only partially successful, that large-scale resource developments are very hard to stop and very hard to modify in significant ways, the Cree have found, with that kind of a joint Cree government environmental review decision-making procedure. Small-scale projects have been modified and their impacts have been reduced, but plans for large-scale hydro development that are very much big public political decisions in which the government is an active promoter have been very hard to get seriously reviewed and very hard to get the projects altered. And I think that's reflected in the memo or the resolution we heard circulated with respect to the hydro project in Hydro-Quebec yesterday. The same thing has been true with forestry development. Forestry development is beginning to expand in the region and affect large parts of Cree lands. And the Cree are really working very hard to try and bring it under control, but it's been a long, hard struggle, and it isn't clear that it's going to work. And I think I might make that the first of my general observations, that it seems to me that the area in which the least progress has been made is the area of regulating the impact of industrial developments in the north and on the impact on the lands, that we keep talking and hoping that environmental review, land use management will work, but in fact, it's working in the areas where there isn't extensive development, and in the areas where there is extensive development, the history has been a very abysmal one. And that remains the area in which the least progress has been made. I think I could pull out just a few more comments of commonalities that struck me. The complexity of subsistence issues is really quite amazing, and sitting around listening to people talk about the examples in Alaska has been very exciting, because many of the initiatives are really bold and taking broad steps, and yet I won't comment on that so much as on the fact that many of the problems that they have to confront are exactly the same problems that it seems to me were confronted in northern Quebec, and they're very complex problems. They're problems of the ones we've just talked about, the impact of economic power and economic influence and the way the governments themselves are closely tied to the large capital interests of corporations and of investors. But they're also the most subtle and complex issues about non-native society. They very quickly tie us into questions about what is the public culture, what are the public beliefs of the society around us. Many of the constraints that exist in James Bay and that seem to exist here in Alaska have to do with public attitudes and values and beliefs and questions about free enterprise and so forth that are really very difficult to deal with, and the strategies that have to be developed, it seems to me, have to confront those constraints as well. Some of the other common themes, of course, are the interests of government departments. Government departments are bureaucratic enterprises that constantly protect their interest, protect the potential for financial expansion, for increasing the size of the bureaucracy, for increasing power. These themes constantly recur. How do you confront bureaucracy? How do you try and avoid confrontation with bureaucracy and still act effectively? Another has to do with the government's own attitude towards how it justifies itself to its non-native public. Now, technically, the term for that would be something like legitimacy. The social welfare democracies that we live in justify themselves to the public by talking, well, somewhat differently here, I think, is one of the basic differences between Canada and the U.S. In Canada, the government justifies itself by its social progressiveness and its social aid by the fact that it redistributes income. In the U.S., it justifies itself, it seems to me, more by the idea of freedom and what the freedom of opportunity for its citizens. But in both countries, we struggle with the ways government itself justifies itself, because the way it justifies itself limits what you can get it to do publicly. And it seems to me so that we're dealing with things that are very practical, capital and money, and we're dealing, on the other hand, with the beliefs and ways that governments explain themselves to the public and the beliefs of the public themselves. And I think that the theme that comes out of that is that the issues are sufficiently complex that there's no one way to go, and there's no simple direction to take. Often you have to confront the public. Other times, when you're dealing with public beliefs and public culture, you have to do things in secret. Sometimes there's opportunities to use government departments and play themselves off against one another. Other times, when you're dealing with the basic way government justifies itself to its citizens, you have to go to the international arena to get outside of the commonality between all the different levels of government and how they justify themselves. And so every opportunity has to be taken, the international arena, the public arena, the private arena, conflict between the different agencies. All of these have to be mobilized in the effort to deal with a very complex set of constraints and opportunities. I think the one thing in the James Bay Agreement was that the people who negotiated it, I think, all felt that there was possibilities within those constraints that they could use, and that there was a real possibility of maintaining subsistence with linkages to government if they were flexible and used those opportunities. And I think the experience so far has been very positive. I think the dangers remain, particularly with large-scale resource development occurring on Cree lands.
Well, thank you very much, Harvey. That was a very, very interesting discussion, and you had the advantage, and so did we, that it was broken up into two pieces, one yesterday and one today, which gave us a chance to reflect on your observations. Well, anybody would like to put some questions to Harvey or make some observations on what he's told us? Tom Lawner, and then Dan Gross.
Harvey, I've attempted to make the argument here in the state that any support that's given to subsistence is in fact an investment in the economic self-sufficiency of the people who engage in the activity. Has there been any measurement of the output side of that investment? That is, if the provincial government invests $10 million in the enterprise, does in fact the Cree community then develop for itself $20 million worth of resources that otherwise they would not be able to have direct access to?
The short answer is no. The long answer is that I think there would be tremendous resistance to the application of any such economic measure of what's being accomplished.
Dan Gross.
I recall yesterday in some statistics that you presented that there is a substantial number of households among the Cree who have taken advantage of this new system. But I'm curious about the fate of those who, for whatever reason, have not or have not been able to take advantage. Have they now arrived at a position of relative disadvantage as a result of this system?
Very complex question. At the general level of the Cree economy, the answer is no. The growth in employment income has roughly matched the growth of cash flow to hunters over the last decade, so that the two sectors have grown about equally. And that's in a period of very rapid growth of employment. At the level of the social pattern in the villages, the growth of employment of Cree people has been tremendous under the agreement with the taking over of government administration and the setting up of school boards and health boards and self-governance. But at the same time, there remain in the Cree communities particularly young people who are not either intensively hunting under income security or employed, and there remains a need well recognized by the Cree and something they're working on very actively to create additional employment opportunities in their communities for that sector of the population. It's a major priority of the Cree organizations at this moment.
Dolly Garza.
I had a question on your joint board. Are there any types of obligations by the government for when the natives have a problem with industrial development overriding what they feel their subsistence rights are? And do they also have a problem with any of the game or fishery resources in terms of non-native interests?
Right. Can I take the second one first? In fact, I skipped that. There's a the question of allocation of resources was a major one that was something that was dealt with. There's the principle of priority to native use, and there was an attempt to act to give a structure, not just leave it as an isolated principle, but to make it a practical administrative affair. And that was done by saying that native people would be guaranteed their present levels of harvesting. And a 7-year research project was done to look at the present levels of harvesting of native people. And then the second principle is that if the game pop, they would be guaranteed an allocation equal to present levels. That means that if the game declines, the non-native use would be cut off first, and whatever could be harvested would be harvested by native people. If the game populations are sufficient that more than the present level can be taken, then the native people are guaranteed the present level, and the rest of the surplus harvest is split on the basis of need between natives and non-natives, but with a recognition that non-natives will get some of it. That's the way it's worded. So that there's a possibility for the native harvest to expand beyond present levels, given the principle of priority, but it will expand only if some is also reserved for non-natives. So that there is a set of administrative and practical procedures for dealing with those conflicts when they come about, but those are guided by the basic rule that nothing happens unless there's a problem. So that we don't envisage a lot of setting up of quotas and allocations, except for species where the government or the native parties feel that it's time to, that there's a problem and it's time to look at allocation in detail. And then there's a set of procedures for doing so. The first part of the question on the review of development, native people sit on, actually, the Cree and the Inuit have separate boards and separate procedures. Because the Inuit have a regional government, their environmental board that looks at, that reviews development is a regional board. And it's probably a more powerful board than the Cree have. It's based on 50% representation and joint selection by the Inuit and the government of a chairman. And that board, because of its composition, has very extensive powers. It can be overridden by the minister in the end, but it's a fairly complex procedure, and if he overrides it, he has to still abide by the principles of minimizing the impact on native people and so, and looking to remedial measures and so forth. The Cree have a board that doesn't have a decision-making authority, that's purely advisory, whereas the Inuit board is really a decision-making board which can be overridden. There are still the constraints. The minister and the government must act according to the principles of minimizing impacts and so forth, but those principles are not sufficient to fundamentally oppose. They emphasize moderation, compensation, remedial measures, rather than this shouldn't happen this way at all. And I think therein lies the problem. And governments so far as I've been able to see, everywhere in the Canadian North have been unwilling to give up that final ability to authorize and approve projects in their form. And it's a very complex situation because governments are active promoters and they're with investors in many of these projects.